Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. I'm Margot True, the food editor of Sunset Magazine and your moderator tonight. And on behalf of the Commonwealth Club, I'd like to thank the Bernard Osher Foundation for supporting tonight's program. It is a pleasure to introduce Samin Nosrat, the author, and Wendy McNaughton, the illustrator, of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking, which just made the New York Times bestseller list. Samin Nosrat is a chef, writer, and teacher based in Berkeley. She's been cooking professionally since she talked her way into a job at Chez Panisse 20 years ago and honed her skills in Italy and as a sous chef at the late Eccolo restaurant, which was also in Berkeley. She's been asked to write and speak around the world about food and cooking, and NPR's All Things Considered show has called her the next Julia Child. Wendy McNaughton is a New York Times best-selling artist, illustrator, and graphic journalist. Her books include Meanwhile in San Francisco, The City in Its Own Words, Lost Cat, A True Story of Love, Desperation, and GPS Technology, and The Gutsy Girl, Escapades for Your Life of Epic Adventure. She's the back page columnist for California Sunday Magazine and the co-founder of Women Who Draw, and has drawn everything from the Women's March on Washington to street in Kyoto to chef's tattoos to winemaking. And she's a fifth-generation San Franciscan. Please welcome both Samin Nosrat and Wendy McNaughton. So let's start by telling people a little bit about how you each came to do what you do. And I thought we'd start off with you, Samin, first, because when you were growing up in San Diego, you loved to eat your mother's delicious, fairly traditional Persian cooking, but you never really got into the kitchen yourself. And then you went off to UC Berkeley to study English Lit. And then all of a sudden you veered off and you became a chef. And how did that happen? And there was a letter in there somewhere that really changed things for you.
So I had a boyfriend my sophomore year, and he had always wanted to eat at Chez Panisse, of which I had never heard. And so we saved our money for 7 months. We saved $220, and and we went and ate downstairs, and it was a really incredible meal, really beautiful and delicious. But what sort of took me by surprise, sort of the most dramatic part of it for me, was the way that we felt so cared for, mm-hmm. and they anticipated all of our needs and were so accommodating, even to the point where the dessert was chocolate souffle, and the server, when she brought it, asked me if I had ever had chocolate souffle before, and I said no, and she said, would you like me to show you how to eat it? And I said yes. So she poked a hole in it, or she said, you poke a hole in it with your spoon and you pour in the raspberry sauce, and that way every bite has sauce in it. So I did that. I took a bite, and she said, how is it? And I said, well, it's really good, but you know what would make it even better? And so, you know, I was 19. I didn't know how rude it is to go to somebody's restaurant and tell them how they can make something better. And I just thought it would be really good with a glass of cold milk. And, you know, I still think something warm with some, like, warm and chocolatey and cold milk is pretty good. And she thought that was really funny. And so she brought me a glass of milk, and she brought us also two little tastes of dessert wine. And at the time, I didn't really know that asking for milk is kind of like uncouth after 10 a.m. in fine dining. And so I still think it was pretty yummy combo. But so I was so inspired. Yeah, it was pretty good. So I was pretty inspired by the meal, and I wanted to be a busser there. I always worked through college. So I wrote this letter to Alice Waters, and I said, oh, I came. I had this really amazing meal. It was so special and inspiring.
You wrote to Alice Waters. Okay.
I mean, I didn't know anybody. It was also, you have to remember, too, it was 1999, I think. And it was just a different time. There was not this, this sort of culture of food celebrity chefs and food bloggers and food TV. It just was a totally different time. So I had only heard of Alice Waters. She was the only name I knew related to Chez Panisse. So I wrote this letter to her and I brought it into the restaurant, and they said, oh, you have to bring that to the floor manager. So I brought it to the floor manager, and the floor manager was the souffle lady. And so so she remembered me. And I also think she was very desperate because she was like, can you start tomorrow? And so So I started bussing tables, and then, you know, it all just changed.
But how did you end up in the kitchen, though?
I mean, you know, from the first moment in any restaurant, you're always sort of walking through the kitchen. And Chez Panisse's restaurant is so beautiful. The walls are lined with copper panels, and there's just these like very sensual fruit and vegetable displays. And all the cooks are wearing their like gleaming white coats. And I was still a baby. I was still in college, and to me, they all looked like fabulous adults who, every time they smiled, their teeth shined, you know. And so it just was a very enchanting place. And pretty immediately, also because you're constantly tasting everything, the menu's changing every day. And so even as a busser, every day before every lunch or dinner service, we would get to taste one of every dish. Mm-hmm. And so we would all cram up upstairs on the back porch and sort of fight over the last bite of like panna cotta with strawberries or fried quail, and I got to taste all these delicious things. And that restaurant really exists for its cooks, and the cooks are sort of held up on this beautiful pedestal. So to me, there was, of course, I looked up to them. Of course, that was what I wanted to be. And as an English major, you know, Silicon Valley hadn't really hit yet at that time. There was not sort of a straight funnel from English majordom to Google yet. And so I was realizing I should maybe have to go be, I would have to be like an advertising, I don't know, assistant or something. My soul kind of cried, and I fell in love with cooking, and I begged them, and I begged them, and I begged them, and they let me stay.
Wow, and it took you, what, about 3 months to finally get into the kitchen and start cooking?
After about 3 months, I probably started volunteering once a week, and then I kept busing for almost 2 years, and I had jobs on campus and stuff, and then eventually, finally, I wore them down, and they, maybe about 2 years later, they hired me in the kitchen, yeah, with pay, yeah.
That's great. Well, Wendy, how about you? Did you have this sort of moment of revelation that changed your life, or was it kind of a slow progression from things you were interested in from childhood, or how did you become
definitely,
an artist?
To get to the place that I am at now and with the book that Samin and I did, it's definitely been a progression. Mm-hmm. I started off studying art. I've always drawn. There was a time when I stopped, but I started off drawing. I went to art school. But like most people who go to art school, I got out and I had to get a job. And it's usually not art that people get. I went and I worked in that evil advertising job. Yeah. Wow. I ended up becoming a copywriter in advertising. And it did not fit well at all. It ended up taking me to... I worked in communications overseas. And I ended up going into social work. Which seems like a left turn, but it all made sense for me, in that I was always interested in doing something that communicated with people and affected them in some way. That didn't quite work either, and about 10 years ago, I was working at a job in San Francisco and living in Oakland, and I was commuting back and forth on BART, and I hadn't drawn in 10 years, not since I had been in art school. And I was sitting on the train, and I looked around, and I saw all these people sitting there totally still, and they were just like these life models that I used to draw. And so I pulled out my little book that I took notes in, and I started drawing people again. And that was about 10 years ago now. Wow. And I started drawing again. And those backgrounds that I described before, all the social work and the advertising, the writing, all that stuff, that all folded into the artwork that I do now.
Oh, that's fabulous, because your output of work since in these past 10 years has just been prodigious.
I do love my job. Oh,
she's been published everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's a Wendy McNaughton illustration. It's in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, you know, of course, Edible San Francisco, which is where a lot of us know your work from, Time Magazine, just all over. It's fabulous. Samin, how did you come up with the idea for this book? Yeah, and can you describe also a little bit about what it is? Because this is quite unusual.
I call it an uncookbook or a how-to-cookbook, because it feels sort of not fair to call it a cookbook. But So, you know, I was so young and I entered this kitchen at Chez Panisse and I didn't know anything. I'd grown up eating really delicious food, but I didn't know how to make any of it. And the menu there changes every day. And so the chefs gather around a table when everyone arrives to work, and the chef in charge sort of describes his or her vision for the menu. And, you know, today it might be Provençal food, tomorrow it might be Italian food, the next day it might be Moroccan food. And so it's always changing with the seasons and with the whims of the chef, basically. And there was, as a person who knew nothing, coming in every day and listening to these people talk about, you know, couscous royale and lamb daube, you know, and all of these different things, it was very overwhelming because most of the time I didn't even know what they were talking about. I certainly didn't know how they were making it, and I really didn't understand how they all could just get up from the table, go into the kitchen, and make everything perfectly without ever looking at a cookbook, without ever checking recipes or asking what temperature the oven should be, or I don't know how many cups of this to use. And so, you know, I didn't know the difference between parsley and cilantro, or the spice jars are not labeled in a lot of restaurants because most cooks can recognize the spices without the label. And so they would send me to go get fennel and I'd come back with cumin. You know, I just didn't know anything and they knew everything. And it was very overwhelming. And so I started to see over time these patterns. And I noticed that every day we always salted the meat for the next day. You know, we always, whenever I was on the savory side, they always instructed me to heat the pan and heat the oil before I added something into the pan so that it got really crisp on the outside. But then on the sweet side, we always had to keep the butter cold so we could get flaky crusts. And there was this fat. I was like, okay, fat. And then, you know, whenever we were tasting and adjusting all the dishes right before service, they're almost always needed a little bit more vinegar, a little bit of, you know, maybe a little splash of wine in that sauce, or just a tiny squeeze of lemon. And so they're always talking about acid. And I was like, okay, something about acid. And same thing with heat too, where I started to realize that these guys were so skilled that, you know, even the numbers on the oven dial had worn away by then. The restaurant had been there for 30 years. And so maybe they had new ovens in those 30 years, but but still there was a way where cooks could just wave their arm in front of the oven and know if it was, you know, hot or warm. And if we ran out of room on the stove, we would build a fire in the fireplace and cook over the fireplace. And so, you know, there's no dial on a fireplace. And so there was a way I started to see, oh, we're pretty much always sort of modulating between like gentle heat and intense heat, and it doesn't matter what that source is. And so I came to the chef one day and I said, I figured this out. I feel so proud. I figured out the way. It's salt, fat, acid, heat. And he just looked at me and he was so unimpressed. And he was like, we all know that, you know, all good cooks know that. And I felt really betrayed. I said, why haven't you told me this in the past year and a half? You know, you've told me, you've sent me home to read, you know, Marcella Hazan and all these other cookbooks. And this isn't in any of the cookbooks. And he said, oh, no, we all know that. But for me, I really saw in that moment that this was not being explained to me or probably to any home cooks. And I knew that that was what I wanted to write about. And I even got out my legal pad and started writing. And then I realized I didn't know anything about writing or cooking. So I put that down. But it became the system I filed everything I learned into.
Yeah, I've heard you call it a unified theory of cooking.
Yeah.
That was pretty great. You know, you can fit it all in there. And then, I thought, you know, the book is divided into two parts, essentially, and you have part one, which is mainly your unified theory. And I wondered if you could give the audience just a tiny little sample from part one, like maybe from salt. You talk about how you layer salt.
Sure.
Which is...
I feel like one of the things that I've learned in the kitchen is about pushing flavors to the edge, pushing all the tastes to the edge, and using all of the tools at my disposal to sort of get the maximum flavor out of something. And so, you know, salt, we all have this relationship to grains of salt. We all sort of recognize them in the salt shaker, but it's in our food in a lot of different ways too. And so once you can start to recognize all of those different sources of salt and really... treat them as tools and power, sort of like power tools, then your food can taste a lot better. And an example I love using is making Caesar salad. You know, Caesar salad dressing has so many salty ingredients in it besides just salt. It has beautiful, you know, salted anchovies and Parmesan cheese, which is a great source also of umami, as are anchovies. It has salt itself. Worcestershire sauce is salty. And I like to pound my garlic with some salt until it's a fine paste, so that also becomes a source of salt. So if you start with the mayonnaise base and you're working all of these ingredients in and you go ahead and add salt at the beginning, if you reach to a point where it's sufficiently salted, but it's not anchovy-y enough or cheesy enough, then it's this great travesty because you can't, your Caesar salad won't have enough Parmesan, which is, you might as well just, you know, jump off a bridge at that point. Yeah. And so, so to me, when I talk about layering salt, it's sort of like thinking about the finish line, thinking about where you want to end up, and then working your way back to where you are. So if we know we want to add a lot of Parmesan and a lot of anchovies, then hold back on adding salt, and that could be the last thing that you add. And that way you've layered so many different sources of salt and flavor into one dish. And then you get to this like maximum flavor punch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to give you a little sneak preview. I know you're all going to rush out and buy this book after the talk, but Wendy did this brilliant illustration of the Caesar salad that I just feel moved to show you because here it says, you know, there's all these great little words on this page. Taste again, you know, taste. And it just so well illustrates what you've just said.
Yeah. That's really the way. And you know, one of the lessons I learned when I was being trained on the Chez Panisse salad station was the cook who was training me was quite hyperbolic. And he said, you know, if at the end of a shift, your mouth isn't raw from all of the tasting, then you have not done your job right. So I don't think your mouths need to be raw, but it is a good idea to remember you should taste something a lot of times to make sure that you're getting where you want to go. A recipe's not really ever enough to get you there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about that later because it's such a good point that you make. And then I also thought maybe you could describe how best to heat oil from the fat chapter.
Oh, sure. You know, this is a good one. And I feel like this is probably the thing, everyone, take this home and put it in your pockets. I mean, not literally, but use it every day. So it makes a big difference in how an oil will taste and how a food will cook, whether or not you preheat the pan and preheat the fat. And so it's pretty simple. I mean, a cast iron pan takes a little bit longer to heat up, but usually if I know I'm going to, I don't know, cook a piece of fish, I'll get that pan going over medium heat. I'll check it with a drop of oil, or just a drop of water. And as soon as that water evaporates, the second you put it down, then you know your pan is nice and hot. And then I add enough oil. And to me, it's really important to add enough oil to create a thin film on the bottom of the pan, which is another reason why I struggle with recipes, because you might be using a 10-inch pan, and I used a 12-inch pan. So I told you to add 3 tablespoons, but really all you need is 2 tablespoons. So it's kind of one of those things where you're just using your senses. You're just looking to make a nice thin layer, and you wait a second for that to start to shimmer. And the second you can sort of see little waves in the oil, that's when you know it's hot enough, and you can add whatever you're cooking. And this actually, you know, that waiting for the pan to get hot and that waiting for the oil to get hot, it might seem like it's taking longer, but it actually, your food will cook more quickly and more evenly, and you'll get a beautiful brown crust, and things like fish and chicken won't stick as readily if you do that preheating.
Yeah, because a lot of recipes start by, you know, heat 2 tablespoons of oil in a pan over medium high heat. So you're heating the oil in the pan together.
Yeah.
And
the flavor will suffer from that for sure. Yeah. Some degrading will happen. And especially if you're using a nice olive oil from Italy, you know, you want to treat that with respect, especially because you paid a lot of money for it. So so you want to get the flavor out of it.
Right. And so you're not a believer in nonstick pans?
I do have one nonstick pan. What do I use it for? I can almost never get my like fried egg right without it. I don't know. It's a good cheat. I don't have all nonstick pans, but I have one. I think it's good to have one. Yeah.
Yeah. Just in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Okay, to go back to your letter writing skills for a moment, that letter to Chez Panisse wasn't the only one you've written that actually changed the course of your life. You've written 2 others that I know about.
One's coming at you, yeah.
And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the second one and then especially the third one, because that led to this book.
Sure. I started working at Chez Panisse around late 1999 to 2000. And then in 2006, by 2006, I had worked in Italy and I was working at a restaurant called Eccolo in Berkeley. And I was in charge of the kitchen. So I would check the reservations every night just to see who was coming, if we needed to
do special treatment for anyone. And I saw that the writer Michael Pollan was coming in, and I was a big fan of his. So I wrote a card and just saying, oh, I'm a big fan of yours. I admire what you do so much. You've done so much for us as cooks. And I would really love to take your class, because at that time he was teaching at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. And I knew he had this class all about the food system. And so I basically, yeah. And then I gave it to the server and I said, please just make sure he gets this. So, so they gave it to him that night. And, you know, I always say, like, either to his credit or discredit, Michael wrote me back 3 weeks later, and he invited me to come in, and I persisted, and he let me into his class, which was a really remarkable thing. You know, by then I had this incredible community of cooks and food people that I was around, and this really brought me into a community of writers, which was incredible, and actually brought me into an office where I still work in Oakland with a bunch of other writers. And by the time I had the idea for this book, I knew that it needed to be illustrated and not photographed, because there are so many, for many reasons, but also because there are so many ideas that I wanted to convey and lessons and stories that I wanted to visually tell. And by then I was a big fan and major stalker of Wendy McNaughton's. And so I remember one day in my office, I was talking about, like, oh, I just wish this woman, Wendy McNaughton, I wish I could get a hold of her so she could do my thing. And the woman I shared the office with said, oh, well, I'm friends with Wendy. And so I said, what? and so I wrote this crazy letter to Wendy. I wrote this crazy letter.
Totally
that,
yeah, crazy, actually. Yeah.
And it said the subject was, you might think I'm stalking you. Or no, it said, if you think I'm stalking you, that's all it said. Yeah. And then it continued, you would be correct. You know, like, and I explained, you know, that I wanted to make this book, and there were so many ideas, and I was a big fan of hers, and we had so many friends in common. And I said, you are the Myra Coleman of our generation.
Okay, but then I have to interrupt, yeah, and say, first of all, there is no, if you guys know, Myra Coleman is an incredible illustrator and storyteller, and there is no other Myra Coleman besides Myra Coleman. But if you want to get to my heart, call me that. Biggest compliment in the world. Yeah.
And so it worked.
Yeah. It worked.
Oh, and I also drew a Venn diagram. At that time, Wendy was drawing a lot of Venn diagrams.
Yeah.
And so I drew a Venn diagram of how all of our friends in common,
right,
and our lives,
our worlds intersect, that all, like, led to, and with a big circle around, you guys know Venn diagrams, overlapping circles, and, like, the big circle around was something like, the reasons why you should do this book. This is a fantastic letter.
Oh my gosh. So you wrote back, like, right away.
I think I took a breath. It was a lot to take in. We went out to coffee like a week later or something like that. And then I met Samin in person. And clearly you can tell if you meet this woman in person, you fall in love with her. So, she was also talking about doing a cookbook. And I didn't, you know, cook at the time at all. So it sounded like a great idea. And we talked a little bit about it and stuff. And then I think I said yes pretty darn quickly.
And did you reveal at that point that you knew nothing about cooking?
I think I might have said something like, I'm not the best cook in the world. Or something like, right? Those people who don't cook kind of play it. But, like, really, I think Samin found out on her own pretty quickly that...
Yeah, I came over, I opened the kitchen cupboards, and it was all balance bars. Like...
That's all we had in the house.
Oh my gosh. A moment of truth.
It's changed. It's changed a lot.
Yeah. How has it changed for you with this deep dive?
We have lots of produce and balance bar.
Harmony.
No, but really, I mean, I cook now. I cook regularly. I would say, like, once or twice a week, make a big meal. So, yeah.
Wow, bravo.
She has her bean pot. She has her cast iron pan.
It's true.
She has her knife. She's ready to go.
Knife.
Yeah.
That's really great. Well, Samin, one of the other reasons I've learned a bit that you wanted illustrations in the book also had to do with the effect of a photo on the reader versus an illustration. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of beautiful food photography, and I've had the great sort of privilege of working on a bunch of magazine stories and seeing how those photos are made. And it's a lot of work, you guys. It's a lot of work. There's prop stylists and food stylists. There are computer technicians. There are, you know, chefs and multiple photographers and lighting people and lots of machines, a lot of machines involved. And it's just a lot of work to make that one perfect picture. And I think, and the point of that is to convey what a dish looks like in its ideal state, you know? And so what is a photo other than a representative sort of capturing of something at its best, which is so beautiful in a really nice food magazine or in a beautiful cookbook. But the point of this book and sort of where I approach teaching cooking from is about giving people the tools to make anything with any ingredients at any time taste really good. And it doesn't matter if you don't have chard, and I'm saying use chard in the frittata if you have spinach. You know, it doesn't matter if you don't eat pork and you want to make a braise, you can use beef. And so there's a way that I think food photography is a double-edged sword, and it can be kind of aspirational. And I didn't want anything about this book to be aspirational. I wanted you to read it and feel like you could go do it. And so I didn't want to give you a picture of what I think in its highest moment something should look like.
Yeah, well, and to have a book like this come out in the era of Instagram is like such a good counterpoint, I have to say. Yeah. Amazing. Well, to talk a little bit about the illustrations in the book, you know, there are so many kinds of illustrations. There's fold-out maps of flavor. There are little spot illustrations of ingredients. There's full-on recipes like the one I showed you guys for, of the Caesar salad. And I wondered, how did you go about producing all this, especially when you were new to cooking? Yeah. You didn't get the manuscript and then digest Samin's priceless recipes and then produce these these illustrations. How did it work?
There was nothing typical about this book.
Or linear, nothing linear.
Nothing. It was a total joy from day one. I'll say that. So one of the things that I was excited about from day one when Samin and I met in that cafe was that the way that she was talking about this cookbook wasn't just that it's like recipes and this is like instructions to follow. It's like a real philosophy. It's a way of approaching cooking and food through her ideas. And I love to use diagrams to communicate big ideas, take a lot of really complicated small information and then turn it into something that's approachable and fun and, you know, visual. So that was like, I mean, that was a big part of the fun of it for me, was to get to learn all of this information. I mean, Samin had a wealth of knowledge and a ton of information that she wanted to share. But she wanted to share it with somebody like me who had absolutely no idea. So like she came over, for example, what was it? The wheels?
The wheels. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are these beautiful fold-out wheels that we made, and it was a long journey to figure out how to do it. What I knew was that sort of one of the basic theories of the way that I learned how to cook is once there are only a handful of cooking techniques, you know, and in the world there's braising and roasting and grilling. And so you figure out how to do these things and then you vary the flavors and all of a sudden your one roast chicken becomes 20 different flavor options from 20 different countries. If you can understand what are the spice combinations to use and herbs and flavorings or the right fats and acids. And so I knew I wanted to make these maps. So I said, well, can't we just make a map of the world?
Right.
And you'll just write in really tiny hand letters.
Right. Really small.
All of the correct information over the appropriate countries.
Yeah. And can you put like 46 different things in Italy?
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, takes two Italies to fill the state of California.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I said, no, that's not going to work. So then we talked about different ways to convey that information. It's basically what she was talking about was a flow chart, right? Like you ask a question and it goes off in different directions and gets more and more detailed. But since it's a ton of information, we kind of took that flow chart, folded it off each other, and it turns into a wheel, right? It's an easy way to explain all the information. So there's three of those in the book. And it was fun also to figure out like color schemes and stuff like that for it. There are some people who have like an incredible innate sense of color and they love that some beautiful fuchsia goes next to some teal or whatever it is. And much respect to that. I do not have that. I like there to be a reason behind everything. And so I went and I looked back at all these old like great master paintings from back in the day when I studied art and found these beautiful still lives that like Caravaggio and Clara Peters and amazing painters had done, and then used the color schemes that they had used for the wheels. So there's all these kind of like hidden references, both in, you know, Samin studied, you know, literature and poetry, and I have this crazy background in, you know, social science and social work and art, and there are these little bits of our backgrounds, I think, that come through in a lot of the illustrations and a lot of the writing.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
It definitely does. And the effect on the reader is just a pure joy and really like great quirkiness, like in the best possible sense.
Or
so,
quirky.
So it has the effect of kind of leavening the theory a little bit. Not that it's any less serious. It's just a joy to read. It's a real pleasure to read. So it's sort of equal parts or just kind of it all. It's actually, it's an emulsion. It's a beautiful emulsion.
That's going to be in the next one.
In this book.
That's awesome.
It really is.
You know, and that was also super intentional because I knew, you know, I'm not a scientist and I had to read a lot of science and figure out a lot of things to be able to put it into sort of regular language. And even so, it still has some textbook qualities to it. And so a big part of why I really wanted Wendy was because she's really funny. And there's a sense of joy and whimsy in her work. She's sort of funny.
I think I'm hilarious.
It was really funny. She would send me things and I would crack up and I would write her back and she'd just be like, oh, that's just a dumb joke.
We had a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. Yeah.
We were on speed dial, like number one for the past 5 years. It was really fun.
Well, every drawing is funny, I have to say. I mean, it tells you a ton, but it's also very funny. And one of my personal favorites are the little illustrations that you include throughout the book that are just Samin was here kind of illustrations. The hand of the cook is felt in how she bites things. Yeah. There's like pieces of things. This shows a cannelé, which is one of Samin's, or your favorite French pastry. This is from the chapter called Keat, and it's demonstrating the proper browning of this little cakelet. And, of course, half of it is gone because Samin was here, says the text. So, and then there's another one that I just love. Oh,
okay, oh, that's
I have
a really
to show
good
this one.
One.
It's, talk about organizing information and making you laugh at the same time. It's called the Pasta Nostra.
Do you guys get it?
And it's the whole
Pasta Nostra.
Get it?
Like,
get it?
Like Cosa like, Nostra?
Yeah. Hear the theme to The Godfather.
That one has a good collaboration story behind it.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, you know, pasta, I lived in Italy for 2 years and I cooked pasta every day for 10 years. And so it's a really big part of my identity as a cook. But I also knew I didn't have room to go into a lot of pasta recipes. And so I felt very torn about how I could convey a lot of information about pasta in just maybe 5 recipes. And so I just started making lists. And I would just write down every pasta shape and sauce and combination that I could think of and look for patterns within them. And I saw that there were sort of 5 basic families of tomato, cheesy, vegetably, meaty, and fishy. And sometimes they overlap. But really, it's these 5 families. And if you can figure out how to make one from each family, you can kind of wing it from there. And so I tried to sort of, there were times where I tried to be Wendy before I would bring an idea to Wendy. And so I would be drawing like really bad Venn diagrams and things. And I couldn't figure out what this one could or should look like. And I because I had stalked Wendy for many years, I knew all of her work. And she had made this really beautiful chart with a journalist named Michelle Legro called the Literary Circles of Influence, or the Circles of Literary Influence, which were all of these ways sort of half funny, half serious, that over the past maybe 500 years, all these different literary people and thinkers have affected each other. And, you know, how Shakespeare led to Lemony Snicket or all these things, right? And so it was this beautiful circles of influence. And I was like, oh, this is kind of like that. So I drew a really rudimentary one and I sent it to her. And then, you know, she went to work and then she comes back and it says the Pasta Nostra, the intermarriage of five great families. So it was just this beautiful, you know, like I fun. Did the, yeah, it was just so fun. It was really, it was so fun. Yeah.
You know, there's just puns abound in this book. They're really, really charming. Actually, one of my favorites, I'll have to show you one more. And then I'm going to ask you, Wendy, to show your favorites, some of yours. This is so simple, but it is so brilliant. Salsa math. Okay, it's a simple equation. Salsa math, chopped herbs plus salt. Okay, chopped herbs plus salt plus olive oil to cover. Use more for a sauce to drizzle, less for a thicker sauce, plus shallots macerated in acid. Then there's the bottom line, herb salsa. That's the total. So simple, so perfect. You could put, you know, any number of combinations into this. And then Samin goes on to explain in words, but you get it all. It's like grokking. Remember grok, that term? It's like, if you are as old as I am, you do. But anyway, here Wendy, which ones do you, a couple of your personal favorites?
There's a couple that come to mind. One is one that Samin knew right away. I think you brought it in. You knew exactly what you wanted. I'm thinking about the eggs.
Oh, yeah, the eggs.
Yeah, there is a page that is, I think, how many steps do we have on there? 10, I believe. It's a boiled egg, that we sat in the kitchen, and Samin put 10 eggs, nine, however many eggs are in there, 10 eggs, in boiling water, and then took one out every minute. And we opened it and then saw what it looked like. And then I painted it each, you know, at every step. And it's arranged very clear, you know, simply. But I love that piece for several reasons. It's a super simple infographic. It shows you something very straightforward that normally we don't get to see. It's really informative. You can make, you know, your choice. Do you like it at 6 minutes? Do you like it at 7 minutes? Right? It helps you make a decision. And it was also like an opportunity to just paint something very beautiful. I consider something a success if it communicates information, if it inspires you to do something yourself, and if it's pleasurable to look at. So I think that's a successful one. Mm-hmm. And then there's another one that I think is a fun collaboration, The Powers of Pie.
Yeah.
You want to?
No, you go.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a page called The Powers of Pie, and Samin wanted to talk about the way that the interaction of
flour and butter.
This flour and butter, but like down to kind of the microscopic level, basically what it looks like up close. Science, but very approachable science. So kind of like you're going into a pie crust or you're going into a tart dough. Have anybody, you guys know Charles and Ray Eames, the designers? Yeah, they made this great film called The Powers of Ten, where they are filming a couple that are lying on a picnic blanket, and the camera goes all the way up by measures of like 10 meters up, 10 meters up, 10 meters up, all the way into the universe, looking at this couple, and then it goes all the way down and goes into their skin by powers of 10 into their skin. And that seemed like it would be a fun way to present this information. So we kind of use that as the structure to go down from like the level of the pie, down in, you know, 10 deeper, 10 deeper, 10 deeper in. So it's a really simple kind of grid that we set up, and it's very visual, it's very engaging. You see it, and it makes perfect sense. If you get the weird reference that's like super design geekery, awesome. That's so fun. That's a total perk and bonus. If not, there's like nothing lost, you know? And again, there's a lot of little stuff like that in this that's kind of, you know, playful. If you get it, great. If not.
Yeah, there's such a sense of play in this book, and it does make you want to play with your food. It really, really does. It really does. Then, actually, with so much information in the book, I thought it might be helpful for some people to just, if anyone here is a beginning cook, what are, say, two or three things that you would start out telling a real beginning cook? Kind of the most important things you would put on a billboard.
Ooh, this is good. Okay. Yeah. One, Taste everything a lot, all throughout cooking. 2, salt your food earlier than you think. In almost all cases, adding the salt in advance, especially for meat, and by earlier I mean yesterday or this morning, or as soon as you got home from work. Make salting be the first thing that you do, because certainly for meat and for many other things, giving salt the time to go all the way in means that your food will be seasoned from within and all throughout. And instead of having just salt on the skin of your roast chicken, the whole roast chicken will be tender and moist and seasoned. So that's probably 2. And 3 is just practice, and don't be worried if you mess up. You know, it's just dinner. You can, it's okay if you mess up. You can throw it out and get a pizza. Or you know, the beautiful thing about cooking, as opposed to writing, certainly, is that it's done. You don't have time to get attached to it, right? You make your thing, you eat it, you serve it, and tomorrow is a new day. And so when you succeed, you, no matter what, you have to start over tomorrow. And when you fail, you have to start over tomorrow. And so I think taste and practice and salt, those are the 3 things.
Yeah. And you know, there's another kind of cumulative effect I think your book has on the way a reader cooks, which is your writing. Because I'm just going to read you a couple of teensy little excerpts. You know, you're talking about how you scored the skin on a duck with a super sharp knife. And you talk about scoring it into a pattern of tiny diamonds, so that it'll help the fat render. And, you know, simmering, it's really hard for a lot of people to know, what is a simmer? Is that slow boil a simmer? Is it moving? You know, and you say it should be barely bubbling, like a just poured glass of your favorite sparkling water, beer, or champagne. And, you know, that's just a pleasure to read in its own right, but it seems to me that has a larger purpose, which is that it gets people to pay attention. You know, to really pay attention. That's how a cook pays attention. Mm-hmm. You notice that it's like a pattern of tiny diamonds.
You know? Yes, I would say that's probably the 4th thing. Maybe the 1st thing actually is learn to trust your senses. And, you know, cooking, I think there's a way where our brains turn off a lot of the time, maybe because you're in a big hurry to get the thing done, or just because you trust the person who wrote the recipe. And so you're just going to read that and turn your thinking brain off and do the steps as they're written for you. But what a shame to not get to sense and experience the senses, you know, and also those, you can strengthen your senses. It's like muscles that you can strengthen over time. Mary Canales, this great pastry chef who used to work at Chez Panisse and now has this great ice cream shop in Berkeley called EC, she has developed this ability. She can be on the other end of her ice cream shop and hear the ice cream in the ice cream machine turning, and it changes keys, like just because the ice cream's thickening, and she knows it's done. You know, like a baby ice cream maker cook, when I was a baby, like they tell you never leave that, you have to stand there and watch it. Or the other day I was making chicken, and I was in the other room, and I heard the quality of the sizzle changing, and I knew I had to come back, and I knew that all the water had evaporated, and now it was kind of frying, and I needed to go tend to it. And so there's a way where if you're paying attention, you can start to pick up these other cues, and it's more than just, is that thing browning, or is it all the way tight and hard, or does it smell right? You know, although smell is a really important one that I think a lot of the time we forget to heed, especially for burning. But yeah, all the senses, really important.
Well, that plays perfectly into the last question I wanted to ask before we take the audience questions, which is, what is your advice to people who tend to follow recipes to the letter?
Ooh, loosen up, guys. Yeah. You know, the thing I'll say about recipes is they're great guides, they're great training wheels, but I think even most people who've written recipes would advise you to not turn off that thinking brain and your awareness, because just think about, you know, John McPhee, for example, has this beautiful book about oranges. And one of my favorite quotes in the book comes from him, where he talks about how when he was working, he was learning about oranges and he was working in the orange groves with the pickers, that the pickers knew which trees, you know, the southern facing trees had the sweetest fruit, and on those trees, which branches had the sweetest fruit, and even which oranges on those branches were the sweetest, and even which end of the oranges on those branches were the sweetest. And so there's a way where an orange is not an orange is not an orange. And, you know, a tomato, we all know a tomato is not a tomato is not a tomato, right? Like a February tomato is not the same as a one you grew in your garden. And so if you're just following that recipe and it says 4 tomatoes in the sauce, maybe that person wrote their recipe in February, or maybe that person wrote that recipe at the height of the season, but they certainly aren't there in the kitchen with you, and they certainly aren't the person who has to eat the dinner. So, so it's in your best interest to taste and use your senses and just be a little bit more present and a little bit more aware, and don't surrender your own good judgment. Maybe my very favorite drawing in the book, it changes every time, but right now my very favorite is a pie chart of the senses. And it has all the senses, you know, take about, you know, like a small wedge, sight, smell, taste, whatever. And then half of the wheel is common sense. And so it's for sure, you know, it's something I think people abandon a lot in the kitchen because a recipe doesn't maybe. And the thing is recipes are not infallible. A human wrote those. I was cooking out of mine today, out of this today, and I was like, oops, put that thing backwards. So, yeah. Yeah. You should still buy the book. Yeah. It's not crucial. You'll still make the biscuits fine. They're just out of order. Yeah.
Oh, so funny. And, you know, the other thing you say about not trusting or not following a letter slavishly has to, you know, and you illustrated so brilliantly, Wendy, with the oven dial that has all the temperature markings like rubbed out with a Sharpie. Yeah. Yeah. Because you reveal the shocking fact about ovens that
it's
I don't
really
think
bananas.
Many people know.
I know. That was a good one when I figured that out. I was sitting in a cabin in a writing residency, and it was freezing. It was February in New Hampshire, and the thermostat kept it like going on and off and on and off, but it would still be cold. And I started thinking about thermostats, and then I started doing homework about how oven thermostats work. And so a thermostat, basically, it's not a very precise thing. It's sort of a general ballpark thing. So if you set your oven to 350, the thermostat won't click on and off until the oven temperature hits, it won't click off until your oven goes past 350 around to 370 or 380, depending on your oven. Because then that gives it some wiggle room to like sort of get back down to 350. And then it won't click back on until maybe 330 or 320. So when you set your oven to 350, you're really setting it to 320 to 380. And so it's not precise. And the idea that it's precise is sort of a misnomer. And it's okay that it's not precise, but you should know that it's okay, you know? And so for me, a big clue about that was when I was making cookies. One of my first jobs as a pastry intern at Chez Panisse was to make these slice and bake cookies. And every week it was the same cookies, and they watched me so carefully how to make them. And they're like, you slice it and you sprinkle the sugar and you bake it for 12 minutes at 350. And I did that for 3 weeks in a row. And then on the fourth week, it was a substitute pastry chef. And she said, you slice them and you bake them for 12 minutes or for 14 minutes at 325. And I was like, wait a minute, what? You know, I was like, wait a minute, what? Like I said, like every week it's been the same. Now you're changing it on me, and the same cookies, everything else is the same. And so I said, I don't understand. Why is it suddenly 325? And she said, oh, it's not a big deal. Like 325, it's just a more forgiving version of 350. I was like, oh, you know? And so there's this way where you start to realize, oh, you know, sometimes that 25 degree difference, it doesn't make that much of a difference. And so if you can be aware and if you can check on the thing, that's the more important thing.
Yeah. Thank you. I thought that was quite a revelation. Yeah. So here's the first question from a nice member of the audience who says, you are wonderful.
I am not
a good cook and like simple, healthy dishes. I need a decent pan or pans.
Oh, yeah.
What should I get? Thanks.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. I'm so excited for you, a stranger cook. get a cast iron pan. Go, and I would advise going to a flea market and finding one of the old Wagner's or Griswold pans, because they're smoother. You know, they get sort of to that beautiful nonstick thing a little bit more quickly than the newer made pans. But a cast iron is sort of your all-purpose, you know, it's an incredible thing. A good pot. This one, I think a Dutch, I use my Dutch oven all the time. I have one of those enameled ones. And you can find, there's the fancy ones that are from France and cost a lot of money, but they also have less expensive ones that are maybe $60 that are really useful. So those are two things I think every kitchen should have. And get yourself a good knife. It's worth investing in a good knife. And it doesn't have to be expensive. A brand I really like is called Forchner Victorinox. It's the people who make the Swiss Army knives. And they make great knives with wooden handles that are, you know, well under $100. And if you have a sharp knife, you can do anything.
What do you think the biggest barriers are for families trying to cook good food regularly?
Time, I think, and shop, and like finding the time to do the shopping. And I have a lot, I don't have kids, so I have a lot of compassion for the families. But I think one great thing, you know, and I just cook for myself when I do this, is cook in bigger batches, especially if you're going to take the time to make a braise or a pot of beans or something. Make enough that it will last a few days. And especially if you make it with blank slate flavors, then you can start dressing it up the next day and turn it into, I don't know, Indian chickpeas, and then the next day Mexican chickpeas. And you'd sort of work the spices in. But if you keep the flavors pretty simple to begin with, then you have the freedom to make all sorts of different stuff. Also, I save all your chicken carcasses and make chicken stock like once every 1 or 2 months. And if you have chicken stock in the freezer, you can do so much. You know, like you can have soup with noodles and a poached egg in it, and that's dinner. You know, I think there's this thing a lot of people, partly because of Instagram and partly because of chef culture and stuff, there's this sort of professionalization or like intimidation of home cooks, you know, and this fear of being an amateur or a fear of serving a simple meal, that that's not a whole meal. But, you know, a chicken soup is a whole meal, you know, like if your family's around the table and you're all eating this stuff and having some crackers, just keep, make sure you always have Parmesan cheese around because that makes everything better. Yeah.
Okay, a question about another essential pantry ingredient. You mentioned heating olive oil. Can you talk about which oils to use when? I've always heard that good olive oil should never be heated. Better to use butter, ghee, or lard.
Yes. So you can absolutely heat olive oil to about the temperature of deep frying. You can't go too much farther than that. It will degrade in quality. But the really, really great sort of new oils that you buy in November and December. So one thing I do want to say about olive oil is that unlike a fine wine, which maybe gets better with age, olive oil has an expiration date of 12 to 14 months. So when you're buying olive oil, look for the production date or the expiration date on the back of the bottle. Usually the production date will be on there. It'll say like harvest 2015, which means fall of 2015, which means it's good until January of 2017, you know, or so. Yeah, you have about a year and a little wiggle room. So go check. I have a friend. I only know to say this because my friend's mother recently told me that she had been saving a bottle of olive oil that she was given for her wedding. And I was like, no, no, no. So that's number one. Number two, if you do buy the freshly pressed oils that come out in the fall, those are the ones that have often are unfiltered, and save those ones for dressing and, you know, drizzling over and garnishing, and don't bother cooking with those because that is really special, that fruitiness. But as the year goes on, and I advise cooking with good tasting olive oil for all your food. It doesn't have to be the most expensive, but you can for sure heat it all the way to saute point. You just don't want to keep it at really sustained high temperatures. For that, coconut oil is a really good one. And I also, there are a couple great locally produced, there's rice bran oil, which is California made, GMO free, which is great for frying. And there's a canola oil that's from family farms called Solio. And that's from family farms all in the South. And that tastes really clean and good. And I really like that one.
Mm. And now here's a question about, can you please share some tips on cooking without oil?
Oh,
listener, an audience member who doesn't consume oil.
Does that mean no fat or just no oil? It's okay. I'll close my eyes so I don't know who you are.
She said specifically without oil.
Okay.
She's on the McDougal diet, which is vegan and no oil.
Okay.
And she says she's seeing amazing results.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. Mm. I'm going to look up the McDougal diet later. I would say, whoosh, oh man, cooking without fat. That's a hard one to be so mean and cook without fat. Yikes.
Steaming?
Steaming, boiling, and using a lot of, what's that delicious stuff that you put on popcorn? Nutritional yeast, which is sort of like vegan Parmesan. So delicious. I would say you have to like make up for the lack of fat with some extra umami, salt, and acid. Yeah. A lot of drizzling with, and also, you know what? It's very funny, actually. I'm glad you asked this. Right when the book came out, I brought some copies up to Chez Panisse to give them to the chefs and for their library, just to, so they would have it. And one of the sommelier who's been there forever, he saw me and he said, "You beat me to it. You took my idea. You wrote the book I was going to write, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat." Except he said, "Except mine would have been called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Herbs." And I, and I was like, "Yeah, me too." Herbs are a big part of the thing. And so I think it's something we forget about a lot, you know, if you're sort of in a rut or you're just shopping in one kind of store. But for me, I always make a beeline to the, you know, like the best 99 cents you can spend at the store, I think, is for a bunch of parsley or cilantro or mint. So start incorporating all these other ways to get flavor into your food if you're not using fat.
Hmm. Okay, we have a couple of questions that are sort of similar-ish, but this question, this person says, what is the best dish you have ever made in your opinion? Or perhaps the one that you remember right now. I'm adding that last one.
Oh my gosh.
Ooh, I want to hear this one.
I don't know, you guys. My greatest success. Okay, I do remember, this isn't maybe the best thing, but this is like a super moment of success, was when I left Chez Panisse, I was still a baby cook. You know, I was still very much a young cook going out into the world. So I went to Italy for 2 years, where I worked in a much smaller restaurant and was given a lot more responsibility and freedom. And I grew a lot in those 2 years while I was gone. So when I came back, I remember one day, I was working at Ecolo, which had a lot of former Chez Panisse employees there. And I said, please let me make, it was summer and we just got like beautiful mozzarella curd and eggplant. And I said, please let me make eggplant parmesan. Please let me make it. And it was this huge production because, you know, I got there at 8 o'clock in the morning and I wanted to make this eggplant parmesan in time for lunch. So it meant like slicing and breading and frying the eggplant. And I pulled the mozzarella from scratch and I made the tomato sauce and I baked the whole thing. And I was doing it in all of these ways that were Italian and not strictly Chez Panisse. And everyone was raising their eyebrows and sort of giving me side eye. And then we pulled it out of the oven and the chefs ate it and everybody ate it. And I remember a bunch of them had to go off to the side because they couldn't believe how good it was. They were had to go have their private moment of like joy where they couldn't show me, you know, they were like, oh no, they just couldn't let me know how good it was, you know, cause my ego would get, it was one of those moments where their eyes grew all big. It was really a good success. Wow. Yeah. That was a good one. Yeah.
That is great. Thank you. Whoever asked that question. Now, how important is mise en place for a busy home cook / mother?
Oh, interesting. Okay. I mean, the answer I should give you is very important, but to be really honest, who has time for that at home? So if you don't know what mise en place is, it's what cooks in restaurants do. It's what professional cooks do, and they get everything ready before they start cooking. And so you have all of your diced onions and your peeled, just chopped garlic and your washed greens. And so I think it's a little bit too much to ask of a typical home cook and certainly a mom with like little people running around to do all of that. And also, do you really want to wash 9 ramekins at the end of dinner? You know, who want? But while I wouldn't say that's necessary, I do think you should think through what you're going to cook or read through the whole recipe and sort of prioritize what's going to take the most time. So there's a way where I feel like I have now an ability to make a dinner in 20 minutes or less because I know the order to make things in, right? Like I get the rice going, then I wash the broccoli, then I get the broccoli going, and then I make the sauce and I fry the egg and sort of my rice bowl's done all within that 20 minutes. But if I had done it in a totally different order, it would have taken 45 or 50 minutes. And so part of it is maybe you don't need to stress so much about the mise en place, but think about what's going to take the longest and work really in a time priority order. That's a strength I think a lot of professional cooks have developed over time that helps them. And I think that's something that can help you at home too.
Kind of like triage.
Yes. Dinner triage.
Dinner triage.
My next book.
Yeah. Well, we have one last question, which is actually a perfect question to end on. What is next for both of you? And Wendy, why don't you go first? Since what is your next project?
Well, I'm cooking dinner. I'm proud to say that's quite honest. You know, this came at an interesting time. Samin really did open up my life to food, and the process of making this book really opened up my life to food.
Are you going to culinary school?
I am. And Samin is going to learn to draw.
She's
not. No, I'm not. That would be amazing.
No.
I think my interest in cooking, with a friend of mine, we found this amazing cookbook that was created in the 50s by an amazing kind of lost designer icon. And we are bringing that back out into the world and reintroducing this amazing designer and chef.
It's so beautiful.
So that'll be coming out in October. But it is cool to see how somebody like myself, who just really didn't have any interest in the world of food and cooking, through this wonderful woman right here, really it has infected me very deeply in all the best ways. Yeah.
And Wendy, what's the name of the book?
Leave Me Alone with the Recipes, The Art, Life, and Cookbook of C.P. Pinellas.
This woman is amazing, you guys. They've unearthed this incredible treasure. Yeah. It's super beautiful.
And Samin, what's next for you?
Well, it's very exciting.
Yes, it is.
But this book is becoming a show. It's going to become a documentary series. So,
you get to see you're going on the road.
Yeah, and I get to go on the road. I get to go to Iran and Korea and Italy and Japan and show how these really are universal tenets, you know. And for me, also, especially in this moment, you know, we found out that it was all happening actually right around the election. And I remember, like, I got really good news, like, 3 days after the election that it was happening. And I was like, I was feeling very tormented. And I said, what is this? You know, what does it mean to be a public person when this is our public? Or what is this meaningless kind of work at this time? And I really came around, and I think at the heart of all of my work is this idea that, you know, and certainly in this book is the idea that good cooking around the world is more similar than it is different, and we as humans are more similar than we are different. And so if I can sort of share that with a really broad audience, I'll be really feel like I'm doing something, and I'm really excited about that. I'm excited to bring, I think also because we all just want to eat something delicious, no matter who you are, right? So it's a great way to bring people together.
Yeah.
That is the perfect place to end. Thank you so much, Samina.
Thank you. Thank you, Margo.
Thank you, Margo.
Thank you so much.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Thank you again to author Samin Nosrat and illustrator Wendy McNaughton of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking, and our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and the web. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
That was awesome. Thank you so much, Margo.